a lot of my books come from something that I felt really ashamed about, and then getting so frustrated or bored by the shame that I end up just illuminating it. And like, infertility is the same. PMDD was the same. Drug use is the same. Because I'm like, I can't carry around the shame.
Greetings, hello, and welcome to The Feminist Present. We are the podcast that uses the gift of feminism to try to figure out what is going on right now. I am Laura Good, your co-host. In a solo episode, I have interviewed the wonderful and brilliant Chloe Caldwell. I'm really excited about this conversation. Chloe's been one of my favorite writers for probably over a decade now. And you'll hear in the interview, she was actually a pretty integral part of how I started teaching at Stanford. Chloe was the person who first sort of put me on the path of teaching, pitching, and publishing. And for that, among many other things, I am endlessly grateful to her. Chloe just released her fifth book, Trying, a memoir by Grey Wolf Press. And this is like a wonderfully indescribable book. You'll get more details in the conversation itself. But like, basically what happened was Chloe sold a book about infertility and her struggles with it and about that process, which is so relatable to so many people. Then, as a little surprise fun pivot for her author life, she had a very surprising breakup right after that infertility project was sold, and she had to pivot both her life and the project itself. I would say, you know, most writers wouldn't like come out with actually writing a book at the end of that process, let alone a book as complex and fascinating and wonderful as Trying. But in very characteristic fashion, Chloe somehow managed to fuse the processes of trying to survive a divorce, trying to survive infertility, and trying to survive life in general into this slim and devastating book. It comes out in August. I believe the published date is August 6th. You should go buy it immediately. I hope, are enjoying a summer, even as like the fascism encroaches and things can seem very overwhelming. I'm so honored that you chose to use this podcast to accompany your cooking or driving or solo hang time or cleaning. Those are just a few of the things that I use podcasts for. I hope that this conversation makes you feel a little less alone. I hope that this conversation reminds you that creativity is always possible and that sometimes it leads us into a more spectacular place than we even imagined. Without further ado, this is me and the wonderful Chloe Caldwell. Hello, Chloe. We have so much to talk about. Oh my gosh.
I'm so excited.
I have so many thoughts on how to do this, but how would you summarize this fascinating book?
Yeah, I mean, this is my first podcast of this book, so I
really
yeah.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, so I don't have anything to say. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have.
Let's find it together.
However, for a long time, it was definitely hard to explain this book. I mean, I began this book in 2021, so it's a year. Many years ago now. And I didn't really know how, well, back then I was explaining it as it's like observational notes on like,
yes,
you know, like unexplained infertility.
Yes.
And that's what it was going to be. And just like kind of short. And I had some books in mind. Like there's this like spiritual book called Notes to Myself by Hugh Prather that I got in my 20s, like off the dollar cart at the Strand. And I have it here on my shelf and it's just like cream and you open it and it's like a vignette, you know, it's just notes on life. So that was the book I presented to Grey Wolf. There wasn't a ton of, it wasn't really like a narrative. And that's what I sold it under. So it was already kind of like experimental and not, you know, a mainstream type book. And then
this is Chloe Caldwell we're talking about here. Right, like, of course. Yes.
Thank you. And so then I think I sold it like March 2023. So I'd been working on it December 2021 to March 2023. And then like I found out that my partner, like my ex-husband, was living like this double life. And then I very quickly got divorced. And so then it was the conversation of like, okay, well, what is this book now? It turns out my editor at Grey Wolf secretly thought that I was going to not be able to continue with this book. Like, she thought I was going to like throw in the towel. Yeah. And like pitch a divorce book, or I don't know, or like need too long of an extension or something. But in reality, no, like, I stuck with this book. It was more like, okay, well, what is wanting to have a child become when you're single and queer? Like, there's still the desire. So it's like looking at, Yuka, my editor, and I began to talk about the book as if it was going from like black and white into color. And it's like, yeah,
I like that.
I know, it's cool. And then like act three is like, you know, it all, everything changes. Act one and act two don't really name characters and people or a lot of like concrete surroundings. And when it gets to act three, everything comes more like kind of more like 3D.
Pulls into focus. Yeah. Yes, I felt that. Yeah.
And I was writing like an Instagram caption the other day and I was like, oh, that's what it is. Cause I just shoot off, you know, random. I don't like think about what I'm, it's like whatever, it's impulsive, whatever comes to my head. So I was like writing. And I was like, oh, get this for the person whose life is about to blow up or has blown up or you think should blow up, you know? And so that's now how I'm going to talk about it, of like, this is a book for like people in their, you know, 35 to 45, whose like life is completely being altered. Yeah.
Okay. I love the black and white into color, but it was just what you were just saying about like maybe someone who needs to blow up their marriage. I was like, this book is both a map of the blast radius in your life of like sort of sudden marital tragedy, let's call it, but it's also a blast cap itself, you know, like it's also an invitation to examine one's own reality and longings and relationships. And I found it really provocative in that way. Okay. We're going to talk about act three, but before we get there, I mean, there was so much that I loved in the black and white part. And I feel like in the opening half of this book, you're setting up both the like drip, drip, drip destruction of your marriage as you're hoping for this baby and going to Trader Joe's and, you know, your fertility appointments and all of the lengths that you go to try to chase this dream. But built, like scaffolded into that is also this meta critique of what memoir is and what the expectations of memoir are. And I'm looking for the class, I'm looking on page 74. I laughed out loud. This was a literal LOL to me. But IVF seems comparable to getting your MFA. You don't know if you'll get a book or a baby out of them, and they will likely put you into debt. Like, truer words, Chloe. You know, I know those calculations. And you're calling up, I feel like the connective thread, in addition to money, that is linking the IVF and the MFA paths that you're drawing up here, is like jealousy and comparison.
Yeah.
And how much jealousy and comparison either a literary career or the pursuit of biological children can create. So I loved how honest you, I don't know if I'm leading up to a question here, but I loved how honest you were sort of about like the turmoil inside your own head and body of like looking at all these people who had what you wanted and being like, fuck this. Like that's such a human feeling. Who has, no, there's no one who hasn't felt that, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I appreciate you picking up on that. I really like that part. And it came much later. It came like when I was already divorced and revising. Like it came, I remember being like in my bed and being like, oh my God, IVF is like MFA. And I remember like texting my editor being like, am I crazy or is IVF like MFA?
I could just it was see just the little notebook note that's like IVF equals MFA, !! Yeah,
totally. And then, I remember Yuka said, my editor said, well, what does that make IUI, which was what I did. And I said, community college, which is also what I did, because I did do community college. So it's like, it's like the like, well, I'll try, but like not go all the way, and it's cheaper and it's more affordable.
Right?
So that I think I didn't, now I'm like, fuck, why didn't that go in? But I should have put IUI it, like community college in, but whatever, now I can talk about it with you. But yeah, I think money is a huge theme in this book, because like, there's that one part where someone's talking about like, oh, I have, you know, insomnia and depression. And someone else is like, there are drugs for that. And that's how it feels with wanting a kid, because people look at you and they're like, there's drugs.
Why can't
for that.
You just like, fix that?
Do IVF? Yeah. And I'm like, I don't have the money up front to do that. And knowing myself and having struggled with, you know, PMDD, PMS and things,
sure.
I'm like, I don't know if I can handle doing a couple of rounds of IVF. And
doesn't
then
seem
up,
like a great plan. Yeah.
Right? Like I was like, I know myself. And I think that that's wise that I did. But another, you know, way I had been thinking about this book and the way I do think about this book is that when I was doing a couple IUIs and going to the fertility clinic and trying to have a child, I was looking for my experience in memoirs, and all of the memoirs ended with IVF.
Yeah.
Like they all ended the same.
And then probably a miracle child too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. There's other ones of like, oh, well, we stopped trying. And that's when we got pregnant. And I'm like, well, that's physically impossible. Like you had to be trying, you know what I mean? Like, I'm
of
like,
course.
So it can be really discouraging because you feel like, okay, well, everyone else did IVF. Am I not trying hard enough if I don't do IVF? But like, what if I don't have, like I, that if I did have $20,000, I would need it for my rent. So I couldn't, you know, I couldn't do it unless, you know, I applied for grants and whatever. And that was my whole conflict during the years of trying to get pregnant was like, am I not trying hard enough? Because everyone else seems to just do IVF and like kind of like shut up about it. You know, it's like, stop complaining, just like take these drugs and just do it and go through hell. And I'm like, I don't know if I want my life to be hell. I was like, my life already is hell.
We've had enough of that, frankly. Well, I guess there's so many threads that I want to pull out from what you're saying, but one of them is just how embarrassing it is to admit that you want something, you know, like I feel like that's a basic sort of human feeling that's being deeply reckoned with in this book that I identified with so much. Like living is just embarrassing.
It's humiliating. It's mortifying.
Writing is the most embarrassing, Chloe. Yeah. Like public humiliation that we do for very little money, you know, and admitting that you want a child and have to put effort towards that is embarrassing in all of those same like desirous ways. Another term that's coming up for me that I don't think I've ever heard or used before is fertility privilege. You know, that's another thing that you're talking about. And you're talking about it in economic terms, you know, who can afford IVF, for whom is IUI more affordable, who doesn't have to fuck with those things at all because someone can just splooge inside them for free, you know, and that works towards fertility. Mm-hmm. So you're charting the ways that what I'm calling fertility privilege is both classed in the economic ways and gendered in like queerness, you know, like by the time there's a really like bomb dropping passage you're getting into in Act Three. If I had walked into a fertility clinic during my hetero marriage, I'd be diagnosed with infertility and they'd recommend I go straight to IVF. If I walk into that same clinic in a queer partnership, having done three IUIs, I'd have to have three more IUIs before I would be diagnosed as infertile. My diagnosis is dependent on who I am dating. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a truth I think that we've known culturally in certain ways, but I haven't heard it articulated so directly. And I was so appreciative of it. Like, can you, how did you come to that conclusion?
Wow. Thank you. That was also a late addition. I was
interesting.
I was reading some articles about kind of what you're saying. I forget the term. It wasn't quite fertility privilege, but something around there. And that just struck me about how the diagnoses were different. So for example, you know, you have to have, quote, been trying for a full year to be diagnosed with unexplained infertility. Even that is crazy. But then, you know, that's for hetero couples because they can walk in and say, we've been having sex. But what do you do if, you're gay and you're 40 and you want to go do an IUI and they're like, no, you have to prove that you're infertile. Like the whole concept is so wild. I was reading... I remember going down some rabbit hole and reading about all of this and just having my mind be completely blown. I also was reflecting on how I kind of felt gay in my marriage because I was doing IUIs and I was like, isn't the privilege of being married to a hetero man that I don't have to do IUIs?
Exactly. Totally.
I was
like,
damn. And there's the part of the book where I'm on Reddit and they're like, oh, and I was saying I was doing IUIs and they were like, well, you should go over to Queerception. Like that's the group you should be in because everyone here is doing IVF. And if you're doing IUIs, that's what all the queer people do. And I was like, okay. So it's like kicked out of like, okay.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, all signs are pointing to this. So, and there is a line in the book too of like, oh, was I approaching my desire to have a child? Like from the standpoint of a queer person, because I would do all of this when my ex-husband was out of town and he was on tour. And I remember at one point he was even going to just like leave sperm for me and freeze it. And it's like, well, why am I married at all? If like, this is what I would be doing if I were single is going to get frozen totally. Sperm. So it can be a bit of a mind, like a mind boggling thing.
Yeah. How the medical process was sort of inadvertently queered for you makes it a queer attempt at conception. And then just the fact that you are a queer person throughout the whole thing makes it an attempt at exactly. queer. And that is a mind fuck when there's a cis man in the picture. I mean, I kind of want to go back to I want to slow down and narrate for the reader that I think what you said, tell me if this is true, that you got this book deal and then like 8 weeks later, your life blew up and your marriage imploded.
God, I guess it was. Is that
a correct timeline? I think you said March to May.
It was. I think the reason I wasn't thinking of it that way was because I was in conversation about
the book.
Yuka purchasing the book to Grey Wolf since July of the previous year. So it had been July, August, like all those, I was kind of generating, sending her work, and we were kind of conceptualizing. But yes, when I signed the contract and got the go ahead, I'll check the date exactly because now I'm curious. But yes, it was March. And honestly, April 3rd, because it was my birthday, my 37th birthday. So April 3rd, 2023 was when.
Does that make you Aries or Taurus?
Yeah. Aries. Yeah,
of course you're an Aries. Okay.
What are you?
Sagittarius, fellow fireside.
Oh, fire.
I mean, I related so much to the way you do as another queer divorced person who used to be married to a man, you know,
We need t-shirts
like the Swifties, but not like the Swifties. I related to so much of the disembodiment and disorientation that you were articulating around like the early shaky weeks of like, holy shit, this major institution structure in my life is falling apart. Like just the text to a friend. Well, my life blew up. I've sent that text about 100 times. It's so hard to know how to, even if you're not making like a public announcement, just to text your friends. It's so hard to know what to say, you know?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
I remember I left just a voicemail for one of my best friends being like, so I have articulated the desire for a divorce. I am mattress shopping right now. Like, give me a call when you can. I got a text from her like 5 minutes later being like, I am taking a walk. I'll call you. Anyway,
oh God. Mattress shopping is so real. Yeah.
Girl, I found a real angel of like, I had like a guardian angel moment at the mattress store where I just found the exact right clerk to help
That's
me set
so beautiful.
Up mattresses for me and my kids. And I got it
That's
done.
That's fantastic.
And, like, it was a real blessing of a moment. Did you have those kinds of moments as you were in your own move out, right? These angels sort of appear.
I love that you said that. I was just talking with a friend today and saying how it's kind of weird to miss the summer your life blew up, but in certain ways I do, because there was a sort of like spiritual rawness that I was experiencing.
Absolutely.
Where I was so open, and it showed me kind of how rigid and closed, and I don't know if I want to say miserable, but like shut down to myself I had been. And suddenly there was no hiding and no wondering anymore. Like the truth was in the open, and I got to make informed decisions. Whereas in my marriage, like when you're married to someone who, you know, is living a double life, you can't make informed decisions because you don't know the truth. So I felt so like raw and just in touch with some kind of like higher plane. And I felt more like in my body and more in my desires, and all of my friendships like became really deep. And like, to your point, like those are some of the most vivid days of my entire life.
Vivid.
Like I can still feel how it felt. I remember everything, like what I was wearing, how things felt, the weather. And it is in the book, like when I moved into that garden apartment, I had, you know, my mom, her husband, two friends, their daughter, some other friends. And it was like one of the best days of my life because it was like a party, and they made it fun because they were like, oh, you're not going to be living out of boxes. Like, what happened to you is crazy.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, when you have two gay guys for best friends, they're like, oh, we're decorating. And they were like making a clothing thing and getting plants and like, and they were like, we will set up your apartment. It's going to look lived in and beautiful. And they did. And I never had to touch a box. And I will never forget that. I mean, it is genuinely one of like the kindest things ever. And it made this thing that could have been this huge negative in my life incredibly positive. I mean, one of the best days of my life, even though my life was in turmoil and uncertain and money was uncertain and, you know, just so many different things.
Everything is uncertain in early separation.
I didn't have a car anymore.
Everything. Yeah.
Because we had shared a car. Like suddenly I'm, and that's in the book too. I'm like, I don't have a car. I don't have a dog. I have a new home. I don't have a bed. I don't like, what happened? Like you suddenly feel like you're 19 and not really in the good way, but also kind of in a good way. So I was holding, I got very used to holding these two things at once of like,
yes,
wow, in a lot of ways I'm in hell. And in like the worst grief ever. And I'm kind of having the time of my life. And not everyone can relate to that unless you've like gone through it. Did you feel that
yes.
way at all?
Oh my God. So every word of what you just said, I felt. I mean, it's like there's both in early separation, there's both a crisis going on that's like melting away everything that is familiar
that
to you.
That you thought was true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that you thought was true. And there's this sudden and expansive possibility of like.
Yeah, anything could happen.
Yeah, I'm going to get crazy. A new bed today. You know, like it's kind of shitty that I have to like find all new furniture, but like I'm also going to get a bed that I'm really excited about. And like, that's great. You know,
yeah.
I mean, so what you were just saying takes me to the second adolescence, but there were two lines that I kind of wanted to connect past the, well, my life blew up text. You have this long sentence summarizing the sort of woozy in-between period where you're going to visit your dad in New Orleans and you say, and everyone else is on planet Earth and I'm on planet divorce.
Yeah.
I was like, oh God, that encompasses exactly what we're talking about of this moment of both profound disorientation and expansive possibility, you know, planet divorce.
Yeah, because you're like, you're just seeing everything through a different lens. Like other people are going about their day-to-day life and they're in routine. And when your routine and ritual is taken from you and you're in survival mode and like, you know, my nervous system, I think it was fucked up for a year. Like
I would be shocked if it was only a year, you know, like
I think
it takes
only now,
so much time.
I think it's only now settling, honestly. And it's been 2 years. Like I said, like I couldn't think about things like grocery shopping. I was like, that's funny. Like, what's that? Like all of these things I had been doing and in my ritual and in my thing and thought I knew what my life was and it's just gone. So you try to like, you know, talk with someone else, like you run into someone, they're like, how are you? And you're like, oh, I'm in hell. You know, you say all these things and then the other person's like, okay,
cool.
They're not having the same experience, but you
they're like, I have to go to the post office now. Sounds good. Yeah.
You become, well, that's the thing. You become the crazy woman that like you have seen also. And you're like, okay, I guess I'm this now, but I can't help it. So I'm just going to like lean into it.
God, totally. I remember talking to Liz Lenz about her divorce memoir, This American Ex-Wife.
Love her
so much. And she was talking about how much, I think we were comparing notes on the process of purchasing things as a single woman, like a car, a mattress. She was buying a house because she lives in Iowa where people can afford those
houses.
And she was like, I just feel like I scare these salespeople so much that it gives me a little bit of an advantage sometimes in these negotiations. And I was so riveted by that. And I was like, oh my God, what do you do exactly to scare them? And she was like, I don't have to do anything. Like I am just terrifying to them by just existing. And I completely understand that now.
Yeah. Like, just by being a single person, buying a bed for yourself, being in your like 40s. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Right? I mean, you also write... I loved this. This is a controversial opinion. Having your life blow up is somewhat fun. It means you're in reality all the time. Friends come into focus. Writing comes into focus. Dormant desires come into focus. Complacency, contentment is gone. It's like being a child again, like being in a foreign country, like being reborn. Like, yes, that is what I'm calling the expansive possibility. I remember texting a friend in exactly this blurry period that we're talking about. Like, I don't know where I am, but I know I feel really awake for the first time in a really
awake.
Long time.
It's awake. Like being awake. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's almost like there's grief around that too. And it's almost tragic because you're like, wow, why was I walking through life like unawake?
Man,
like,
oh, 'cause
I think of myself as a really self-aware person, and like, I'm a writer, and I, you know, like have my spiritual practice, right? And like yoga and things. And I thought that I would have known if I had been in this kind of bad place. Yeah. What is that? But then you feel awake and you're like, I could have been feeling like this the whole time. But I guess that's the nature of life. And we go through periods of being more or less awake. But God, that woke me up for sure.
The image that's coming to me as we're talking about this awake feeling is when I got to my new apartment, like my version of the like gay team that you had was just like these, I hired movers for the first time in my life. I had never had professional movers, and they were angels, and they were incredible. Fun. And they hung all my art, and they put together like the bunk beds and the bookshelves. And like, I could cry just thinking about them.
Yeah.
But I had this experience where I got everything up on the walls, and then people would come over and be like, oh, I had never seen this poster of your book before. Oh, I had never seen this piece of art before. Whoa. And I would be like, I literally had this the whole time. But then I would think about where it was in my marital home, and they were all in the like darkest, most remote corners of the home.
Wow.
And there was just something really like symbolic about that.
That's
change to me.
Really amazing. That's so telling. Wow, I love that story. That I can absolutely relate to that. I didn't have that happen, but I did. I remember when I took everything that was mine, and I had
how much did you take? Like, did you take furniture? What?
Just everything that like everything that made sense. Like that was mine, or that we had purchased together. Like, you know, I had lived by myself for a few years before I moved in with my ex-husband. So it was very clear of like what was mine and what wasn't. But even stuff we had purchased together, like I just took because that just made sense. Like he was at like rehab and I don't know, it just obviously made sense. I was the one that needed like this new place to live.
Sure.
So, but as I was like getting everything, like hanging everything, I was like, wow, most things were mine anyway. Like I was like, all of this art was mine. It came from mine from when I was single and moved in, or
the
I bought it.
Vivacity in the house was me. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I don't feel like I don't have stuff. Like I have everything I need and more. And I was kind of shocked actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was almost like, and that's why there's the line in the book too, where my therapist was like, well, you never fully fused, she said to me.
Oh,
because
yes.
It was really easy for me to actually like get my stuff and go.
This is revealing. Yeah.
Compared to a lot of people. I mean, that said, we didn't have, you know, biological children. We didn't have a house, you know, so it was somewhat simple for me. Even the divorce itself was pretty simple because we didn't have assets of anything.
Mm-hmm,
so, yeah.
But that point
but
about not fully
yeah.
fusing really bears itself out in the imagery that you're drawing. That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah.
I mean, you're also describing like the act three begins with this quote from Maggie Milner, the second adolescence, like the second first love, is a time we have few legends of. And I just circled second adolescence. I was just like, this is exactly where I've been. This is all, even my friends who are still married and or straight, like this is all we've been talking about lately is like how this, I don't know, I think Anne Helen Peterson calls 38 to 42 the portal period.
Oh, I love that. I didn't know that. Okay.
There's something that happens to women in this, like, just at the, on the doorstep of perimenopause, like, midlife, early midlife moment.
Yeah.
Like, if you had to describe your portal, how would you describe your portal?
Oh, my God. I don't know.
To describe second adolescence. Laura. I mean, I guess I'm holding it. I'm holding it
middle.
In my hand.
Absolutely. And, like, I'm in the thick of it, so it's, like, hard for me to even see, but I just know.
But you are such a devoted chronicler. Sorry to interrupt you. That just made me feel very strongly that you are such a devoted chronicler of things as they are happening. Mm-hmm. You know, like I feel like that's kind of a hallmark of Chloe Caldwell writing.
Is.
So
yeah.
I'm especially interested in what you have to say because of that.
That's so interesting. Well, I feel like, I mean, I know what happened to me and I know what happened to and is happening to a lot of my friends. And then like someone like you, for example. Okay. So like I see these other writers around me. And like one day I got your Substack and I was like, well, it happened to her too. Why is this happening to everyone? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like I was like,
yes.
And we're all around the same age. And so I don't know, like, my word for it. I definitely feel like I had a second adolescence and am in one. Like, that's really how it has felt. And a queer adolescence. Like, I think I was stunted from when I did have my first queer experience, which more or less was late. It depends who you're talking to, but it was, I was like 26. But then, like, in my 30s, I didn't have really that many. So it's like I'm kind of stuck at 26, if that makes sense, like, it, in terms of, like, queer, like, queer life. So that's not answering your question, but I don't know. 38 to 42 is just really striking me. Like, I just turned 39 and I'm like, why do I feel more free than I did at 30?
This is the portal. What is it? This is exactly what we're circling around. It has to do with freedom. I think it has to do in the women I feel I am and that I'm seeing. I think there's something in it that has to do with a setting down of pain tolerance, by which I mean the divorced women I know tried really hard to save their marriages. You know, your book is literally called Trying. I don't know if you knew that. And I mean, it's like the amount that they could take and how well they could sustain difficulty was at first a strength and then became a profound liability. Wow. Like, I'm including myself in this group. So there's I think what we're calling the portal has to do with realizing that what we can take is not necessarily equivalent to what we fucking should take. That's you so know? Good.
It's a reckoning, really.
It's a reckoning. Absolutely a reckoning. Yes. Yeah. You know, like, you could have stayed with this guy who was going to masseuses and concealing substance abuse. Like, many people choose to stay in that relationship. You made a choice, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a choice I'm really happy with. And I think, like,
yes.
To your point about being an Aries, I'm pretty decisive. Like, and that was, I think I tried because I learned a lot about the truth early April, but then the truth rolled out April through May. And then by the time I had the actual truth of, like, prostitute stuff, I was like, I'm out. Like, I was just like, I was like, to your point, I'm like, this is too much even for me. Like, I was like, I have one life and I'm not devoting it to this. I'm sorry. Like, it was really fast. And
yeah.
I went with my instincts after, for a while, not following my instincts because I had been picking up on, you know, things that didn't feel right. And I ignored it and told myself I was crazy and fell into that trap. And you know, I saw that you had Sarah Manguso on the podcast. And
oh, my God, that book was a barn burner. I'm going to listen to that
tonight. Yeah. Yeah. I read that book in one sitting because I was like, wow. Yeah. Horror story. Like, she really captured so much for all of us. Like, she really did, like, the Lord's work with that book.
Dude, I couldn't agree more. And the detail that haunts me about that book, in which I think she's characterizing the sort of learned helplessness of men who are married to women, is when the husband character doesn't put things in the trash, he just perches the thing on the side of the trash can so that she has, I was going to say someone else, but obviously she has to put it. Yes, you know, like, that was such a devastating detail. I mean,
that's everything. That's all we need, right?
Oh, it's one page. My God. Yes. I mean, okay, so as we're circling around the portal, another line that really struck me from this book, you're obviously working off Virginia Woolf, but you say a room of one's own, a divorce of one's own. Like, what does a divorce, that was such a vivid and impactful line to me emotionally. Like, what does a divorce of one's own mean to you?
Oh, I love that you called out these lines because we were thinking of doing, like, if we did a tote bag for trying,
oh yes, oh
what
god
would it say, and you're pointing to the ones that I wrote. I was like, hell, I yes. think it would either be, well, my life blew up, or a divorce of one's own, or try having, we're, I think we're gonna do try having nothing because there's a part of, like, women talk about having it all too. Try having nothing.
Yeah, we can't. What if we can't do hard things? God damn it. Yes.
That's I'm glad you like that. I thought that was funny. That's an early edition. That's like 2021. Thank you. You see me.
I feel like a divorce of one's own tote bag would absolutely crush, and you should sell them for like $50 each so you can be a millionaire. Yes.
And it also takes a very certain, like, a specific type of person to have the gall to wear that.
Oh, God, you know what I mean? Yes.
But I mean, it's good signal to show you're single or whatever.
Oh my God. I have to tell you, this is me, like, blowing up my own spot a little bit, but just this weekend I was at a family wedding. My little cousin was getting married and he happened to be marrying a woman from Santa Cruz. So it was local to me. And Chloe, it was just the straightest, most Republican event I've been to in this queer period. And what I wouldn't have given to be carrying a divorce of one's own tote bag, you know.
Oh, my God. Yes.
As they read a mass, like the Catholic mass service included them praying for the sanctity of all life beginning at conception.
Yikes.
I am not drinking this fucking Kool-Aid. I felt so divorced at this event, I guess, is what I'm highlighting.
Oh my God.
You know those moments where you just feel really divorced? It was one of those.
Oh, that's such a good... You should write about that for your Substack.
Feeling like, divorced.
Divorce is a feeling. And there's a...
It is.
There's a meme I saw last night that said, I've never been married, but I feel like I've been through at least one divorce. And I'm like, that's really funny.
That's kind of a personality type. Yeah. Are there moments where feeling divorced pops up for you?
You know, it's funny. Like, I feel my life is so surrounded right now by either divorced people, single people, people wanting to divorce, that I don't feel like I'm in the world where I'm like, oh, I'm sitting with all my straight married friends. Like, sure. I think I've worked really hard to not have
that. Not be in that life. Yep. Yeah.
Like,
good for you.
I know, right? And then like, I have a lot of younger friends because of all of the years of teaching and all the people that read my books, like end up taking my classes. And like, so I'm around young people all the time because I'm teaching all the time and they're usually in their 20s. So yeah, I don't know. I think I'm around divorce culture, but God, where do I feel? I probably, if I went to a wedding, even if it was like a cool wedding, I would probably still feel it come in.
For sure.
I don't know. I think I like the identity really worked for me more than marriage.
Well, it strikes me that you are, it's,
even though I didn't want to, this wasn't my plan, but like,
no, it, of it, course not. But divorce, I have to note, was normalized for you by your parents, I have to believe, to a certain extent.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you were talking about your mom showing up to help you move and set up your new apartment, I'm like, that's a woman who's been through divorce. So that was some of the first writing that I ever loved from you, was writing about your parents' divorce and how that was in your adolescence, but also how fiercely loved you felt by them all through that. Like that there
absolutely.
Was never a failure in the feeling of their love for you, which is a real victory for divorcing parents, for fuck's sake.
True.
You know?
Yeah, no, that's so beautiful. Yeah, thanks for saying that. Yeah, I think I didn't see divorce as like failure.
Mm-hmm.
However, I probably did, you know, in some ways get married to like see if I could like heal it.
Rewrite
and
that
then it's
story.
Like, well, nope. Like, which is fine.
I tried.
Like,
yeah.
But honestly, divorce has given me so much more than marriage did. And
yes. Oh,
and you have
God,
to
yes.
get married to get divorced. So, and like, there is something about the magic of getting divorced. But to your question about Virginia Woolf and that was just sometimes for me when I'm writing, I'm just joking with myself. So it's like, I was like a room of one's own. Whatever of one's own. And then I'm like a divorce of one's own, you know, like as an inside joke. And I just think it's funny. But there's a deeper meaning to it, of course, because we all have a divorce of our own. And like, they're similar. Like we said, like a lot of people in this portal, we're all going through very similar things. Like it's actually uncanny and eerie. And at the same time, we can only experience the specifics of ours in a way that's almost painful. Cause it's like, you want other people like, oh, did you feel how crazy this felt? And they're like, no, you know? So it's a divorce of one's own. It's like, you have to go through it by yourself, unfortunately. Mm. Yeah.
And that's what makes it another portal. Like that's that isolation is what makes it both an island and a portal. Yeah. I mean, the humor comes through in that line and it is funny, but I also think that humor is a messenger of intuition, you know?
Absolutely.
And I think that the way that meant so much to me, and I think this is true for a lot of women, is like divorce felt like the first thing literally in my life, probably except for writing, that I had ever done fully for myself, you know, that like I was not doing for anyone else. You know what
that's
I mean?
Huge.
It's
huge,
you know?
I feel the same way. And I think that's why it's been so empowering. And that's why writing is also empowering. It's like, okay, this is my decision. No one else can fuck with it. Like no one else is sitting next to me at my computer writing. Like it's, I get to make all of the choices and it does feel very similar with divorce, and marriage is the opposite, right? Because marriage is like,
exactly,
okay, you're merging, you're fusing, you're compromising, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And it's like, eh.
Do all these toxic things to survive it because you can't leave. Yes, totally.
Right. And that's why I love, you know, my friend, the writer Hannah Tennant Moore, she's a novelist and a poet, and she blurbed the book, and her blurb is so funny because she said, trying shows something like that. I'm paraphrasing, but like, mm-hmm, trying shows how our culture makes women batshit crazy and then like gaslights them into thinking that this craziness is normal adulthood.
Yes.
And I think that happened to me. And like, when I look back at Act One and Act Two of Trying, I'm like, damn, that was depressing. Like, yes, I was alone. What's the point of being married if I'm alone all the time doing emotional labor of like going to the fertility clinic alone, doing it, going through the emotions alone, doing all of the paperwork for the fertility clinic alone, doing meetings alone, going to acupuncture, going to all these support groups for fertility. Like, I was
cleansing your house of every potential toxic chemical. Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God. Like yeah, that was a fun day for me, was like sitting in my living room, like reading fragrance and thinking like, I'm like, wow, life really didn't have to be that. You know, the part that broke my heart when I glanced at it the other day, and this was a later edition too, because I had opened a journal when I was divorced, and I saw in the journal, it said like, my self-worth is tied up in my fertility and I can barely enjoy a margarita without thinking about it. And I was like, mm-hmm, oh my God.
Like, your head was like, really down the gullet of something. Yeah.
Now I'll drink three margaritas and have a great time. And yeah, and not feel any guilt. But at the time, it was all guilt, shame, like low self-esteem, beating myself up. Shouldn't drink this. If you drink this, you know, you won't get pregnant. And it's just like, it was a completely different world. And I'm glad I experienced it. And I'm also glad I'm not in it anymore. And I think, God, I mean, yes, I hope it's going to be relatable to other people, because I was really isolated and I didn't, yeah, really know how to talk to people about it. I think, and I was thinking about this the other day, like a lot of my books come from something that I felt really ashamed about and then getting so frustrated or bored by the shame that I end up just illuminating it. Mm-hmm. And like, infertility is the same. Mm-hmm. PMDD was the same. Drug use, sure, is the same.
Sure.
Queerness, like even like women, like that was like, I was like, am I okay? I just had this weird experience. Like they all come from shame and then like, writing into that because I'm like, I can't carry around the shame. I'm just going to exploit to your point of like, it's so embarrassing. I'm like, it's so humiliating, but it's worse when I'm isolated,
yes,
and feeling shitty. But then when I put it out, I feel like more connection. Like now I'm connecting with you. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, the thread I was just drawing through that is like, one of the things that's been satisfying about knowing that divorce was the right decision for me has been looking around and realizing that I can't name a single marriage I envy, you know, like I can't name a single, like I don't see it, you know? And same. So that dichotomy then begs the question, like what is the opposite of marriage? You know, it's not quite divorce. Mm. It's like, what is the opposite of that kind of feeling trapped and in lockstep towards the same conformity and all of those things. And I think, at least in the way you articulated that I identified so much with, it's eros, you know, like it's just centering desire in your life.
Absolutely.
You write on
which our culture hates. Yeah.
Yes. So much from women. Oh my God. I mean, you're quoting a voice memo from a friend on 152 when you say eros is literally the meaning of life. Straight people have no idea what life can be like, the play and expiration of it all, the novelty of being alive. Like that just kind of reminds me of the difference between, I'm just going to speak in really reductive and revealing terms, but the difference between sex with women and sex with men to me is sex with men is like a race and sex with women is like taking a walk, you know? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like eros is the opposite.
Sex with women is like forest bathing.
Yes.
And sex with men is like running a marathon or like,
exactly,
having to get to the finish line of a marathon that you don't want to run.
Or like running a turkey trot 5K on Thanksgiving, you know?
Like which not I've even, never done.
No, I've never done any of those running.
Because I don't want to, yeah.
Fuck that. Absolutely not. But like Eros is the opposite of running a 5K on Thanksgiving.
So beautiful. That's so beautiful. Yeah, my friend who sent that voice memo, we had a joke for a while because she's also gay and divorced. She's the one in the book who had posted on Instagram, "In short, I'm gay," when she announced her divorce to a man.
Icon shit.
I know. And yeah, and so we had a joke that we were on, you know, Taylor Swift has the Eros tour, and we're like, we're on the Eros tour.
Yes, like, you life, are. You know? Yes. You're totally on the Eros tour.
And it's great and it's fun. I mean, we just get this, you know, one life. It's like, I don't want to be miserable driving to the fertility clinic crying. Like, I mean, I'll do it, to your point. I'll do it for a while.
Like, yeah.
But at a certain point, I'm like, I have to change my life. Like, this isn't going to be my path because I gave it a really good shot. And now I'm going to turn around. You know, I'm going to pivot.
Yes. God, the bizarre connection I was just making in thinking about the way you described driving to the fertility clinic. Like, I loved the extended meditation on always going to Trader Joe's when you drove to the fraternity clinic.
Yeah.
Did I say fraternity clinic? Fertility clinic. God save me from ever going to a fraternity clinic. But the thought I was just having is, like, Trader Joe's was your husband in those moments. Like, Trader Joe's was standing in for the care and nourishment and pleasure and sensuality that a husband should have been there for. Like, should have been holding
me.
But do you know what I mean? Like the you needed sensory pleasure in that moment because you were being denied it by the bolster of support who should have been there, right?
That's amazing. I will be quoting you on that. You're right, because it was like consistent. It was always there.
Pleasurable.
It was pleasurable. It was caring. It was like reliable. It was like, oh, I can go here and feel, taken care of. I can get flowers. I can get chapstick. I can get, you know, like popcorn.
God, I'm having another therapy realization as you're talking about, like, the way you frame it in the book is you treat those things sort of like they're indulgences, you know, like they're little guilty pleasures that you shouldn't really be giving yourself.
Yeah, I know.
But that just feels
so true.
They feel very elemental and non-indulgent. And
I know. I'm way more indulgent now.
Good for you. But like that you would think that was indulgence seems to speak to the dearth of pleasurability and like nourishment that you were receiving in your life at that moment.
Yeah, you're blowing my mind.
Trader Joe's means so much more than we thought it did.
I mean, I've always known, because I'm like, something is up with this place. Like, why?
I loved it.
Because it does show up in a lot of people's different kinds of writing, and like, it's just such a world and such like a culture, and there's nothing else exactly like it. So yeah.
Totally.
I'm glad you picked up on that. Trader Joe's was my husband. My husband, Joe. Yeah.
Yep. I mean, the connection that makes to my life, this is really something. But I have learned that if I am ever hypothetically on mushrooms, the thing that I must have within arm's reach at all times is Coca-Cola. And there's like a biological reason for this and like an emotional reason for this. The biological reason is like blood sugar is a good thing to have, you know, like to stabilize something quick.
Absolutely.
But I had this tripping moment once where I screamed at my friends, "Coke is my dad!" Because my dad has drunk Coca-Cola like every day of his life. And it's like something
so
I deeply associate with
him. Yeah, exactly. Love that.
Coke is my dad and Trader Joe's is your husband. That's what we've learned today.
That's the poll quote. It's so there funny it you say that. My friend the other day, she said to me, Coca-Cola is healing. And so you guys are onto something.
It really can be in certain contexts. You know, I don't necessarily co-sign my dad's drinking it every day of a life, but like for certain moments, it can really pull through.
It can be.
What else? Is there anything that we didn't talk about with this book that feels urgent to you?
I mean, I think what I like about this book is that it's like ended up being about multiple things. And I do think it's kind of like hard to pin down. Some people will
read it.
It
resists resolution very deliberately. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And some people will read it as a, you know, fertility book, and some will as a divorce memoir, and some as like a writing type of book. And I think that that's cool. We'll see. I have no idea.
We will see it. No, but it is.
We'll see. You know, I'm proud of it. Like, I'm proud I was able to.
I think you should be.
Write through while that was all happening in real time. Like, again, that wasn't the plan. And it's interesting to me to think of all the different ways the book could have went. And ultimately.
Oh, God, yeah.
You just get one. So, you know, could I have kept working on it another 2 years? Yeah. But at the same time, would I want to and like stay in that? No.
Yeah. I just had like a very intuitive, like, you've got other shit to do, you know, like, yeah, you don't need to be writing a divorce book for 3 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So no, I really appreciate your careful read. I mean, what a delight for me to have my first conversation be with you. What a full circle too.
Such a full circle. Thank you. I mean, yes. I mean, the reader should know, the listener should know, and the reader, anybody using any sense should know that, like, you are the reason I have a job today. Like, it was Chloe
giving
Caldwell.
Me a lot of credit.
No, it's, I mean, you were such a crucial link. I mean, I was sitting in my backyard talking to you, being like, who do you know who teaches how to pitch? And you were like, you do. I will give you an email address. And here we are, full circle.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
The book is Trying. The author is resplendently Chloe Caldwell. thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Laura. I can't wait to hear this and be well.
The Feminist Present is a production of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The co-hosts are Adrian Daub and Laura Good. This podcast is produced by Ana de Almeida Almiral. We are especially grateful to our feminist colleagues, Allison Bell Crossley, Jennifer Portillo, Cynthia Newberry, Leah Gottlieb, Bethany J. Nichols, Jessica Lopez, Susan Krieger, Argavon Salas, and Moira Donegan.